Down through the history of religion, there has been tremendous emphasis upon vigil. Vigil has always been part of man's spiritual quest for reality. And it seems to be based, at least in part, on the biblical statement, "Be still and know that I am God." The ancient people depended almost entirely upon internal mystical experiences for their concepts of reality. Much the same were the people of the Southwest American Indian tribes and nations. Vigil was a very common Indian practice. In fact, it was indispensable to the maturity of the growing child. He had to seek always from within himself for those strengths that were to support him through the rest of his life. I think one point that we have to realize is that antiquity did not have the privileges and the protections that we know. And as a result, the child could not depend upon the strength of his community. He could not depend upon the consistency and survival of his tribe. He could depend only upon inward strength. And his quest always was to strengthen the internal life of the individual. Now, as we look at contemporary situations, we find more or less a repetition of the old situation. Today, we are learning that it is not possible to depend entirely upon our social protections. We realize that we are not in a secure position, even though we may have done everything that has been required of us by the culture to which we belong. We must have personal strength, and this is what is generally lacking today throughout the world. We are depending upon something else to do our thinking for us, to do our protecting for us, to bring us happiness, wealth, all these things. All depends upon what some other people do. In the older world, everyone had to do for himself. And to do this successfully, he had to have courage. And where was he going to find courage? He could not find it in anything except his religion. Courage was impossible to the ancient person without some foundation in faith or integrities that were of a spiritual or at least philosophical foundation. Also, in those older times, when man got into difficulties, there was no one to get him out but himself. Everything depended upon his own ability to survive. He must find his way through the inconsistencies and inconstancies of peace and war, of plenty and famine, of plagues and earthquakes. There was nothing that he could do to save or correct and condition himself except inward strength. So today we remember the old idea of vigil. One of the classic examples of vigil is a painting of a young knight in armor kneeling in front of the altar of his cathedral, holding up the cruciform symbol of the hilted sword, and also praying. Before you could be consecrated as a knight in the age of chivalry, he had to do vigil. He had to remain alone in the church from dark to dawn, occupied with nothing but the contemplation of his place in a divine plan. This was his only hope. He had to have strength to bear the responsibilities of chivalry. He had to be dedicated to principles above selfishness. He had to have courage, not only of the body, but of the mind. And the only way was vigil. Among the American Indians also, of the Plain Country, the vigil was man's introduction to the universal religious mystery of life. The young Indian performed vigil. And in the vigil, the visions came. by which his life was directed and conditioned and led in the way that it was supposed to go. Older Indians with problems and troubles also needed the refreshment of divine association. They went out at night to some quiet place far from the hurry and bury of even tribal life. They placed the four play-up rooms at the corners of the world, then sat down and smoked the calumet, the sacred peace pipe, which was the smoking altar of the Indian religion. Then, quietly, the Indian sat back, closed his eyes, but did not lie down. He had to sit up all night for his vigil, and simply added a few words of prayer, "Father, show me the way." This was the direct contact. This was the religious ritual of many of the tribes of American Indian peoples. They had a firm belief that they lived in a world of life, that they were surrounded constantly, not by emptiness, but by a strange divine habitation of all kinds of creatures and beings, some dangerous, some benevolent. But in vigil, at night, the problem was a little more difficult than in the daytime. Out there somewhere in the desert or in the plain, there was no silence in the night. The animals of nocturnal habits came out. Strange sounds were heard, howls. Light shone upon the eyes of animals in the distance. Everywhere there was rustling and turning and twisting, and the Indian had to remain completely integrated against the strangeness of darkness, which was the Indian symbol of ignorance. Everything that is ignorance lives in the dark, and the dark is full of sounds, of hazards, of mysteries, and of wonders, and of fears. And it is only the courage of the inner self that can help the thoughtful person to live in a world of ignorance and still keep his faith, keep his beliefs, keep his wisdom, keep his religion. We know in the Bible that the prophets went out into the wilderness to fast and to pray. We know that all the way through Eastern and Western religions, what we call now meditation was very important. Meditation was silence, a silence within the self that was not weakness, a silence that was not emptiness, a silence which was a strange peace rooted in the realization of the utter security of integrity. That which was right had nothing to fear, and that which was wrong had little to hope for. So all these silent communes between the person and something within himself, these were the most important of all circumstances. Now when the modern religionist prays, even in the small vigil of a few moments, he prays to God or to what he considers one of the messengers or avatars or saints of deity. And he is reasonably expectant that that prayer will be answered. Now, what is the basis of his certainties in this matter? In the course of the day, hundreds of millions of prayers go up from every part of the earth. Is there somewhere, anywhere, a God that can hear them all? Is there any God anywhere that can meet all the needs that these supplicants feel is necessary to their survival? The atheist says, no, it's impossible. The normal theist simply regard deity as an omniscient ear that can hear all and will sit quietly with that conviction. But the mystic, who has understood a little better and a little deeper, has a different conclusion. Of course God hears the prayer, because it is the God in you that is the hope of glory. The divinity in each of us is a power that we reach through vigil. It is an ever-present deity, not out in space listening, but in our own hearts and minds, omnipotent and omnipresent. Therefore, when we say, Lord, listen, it is the God in us that is the hope of our salvation. Now, it's not difficult to understand why ancient people believed this. They believed it because they found that the prayers were answered. They had constant testimony that when their desire was right and good and proper and sincerely presented, there was a good probability that it would be answered. It would be answered because of the power, the tremendous reservoir of divine energy that is locked within each living creature, from the smallest to the greatest. Everything has its root in deity. And it is this eternal root, diffused everywhere, that experiences the possibility of divine intercession. So in the olden days, there was no question about who was going to answer prayer. And sometimes the individual was disappointed. The prayer was not answered. And the need that he felt so deeply was not fulfilled. Probably this caused him to have some doubts and might even change his religion. But it was not the fact involved. The reason it wasn't answered was because there was some reason in the person by which it could not be answered. There was something wrong in the person who made the prayer. Therefore, it was not believed in most cases that vigil was something in which you suddenly leave behind a world of doubts and misgivings and in a few seconds achieve union with the divine. Vigil was something that the individual had to prepare for. Vigil was something that the child grew up with, always seeking, always determining that the best part of himself should always be approached with spiritual integrities. Therefore, in vigil, as it was then anciently practiced, there were certain preparatory rites. One was purification, symbolized by means of the water of benediction or of christening. This purification was the preparation of the person to receive his own higher part in communion with himself. He was preparing the house that the Lord might dwell therein. Not that the God did not already dwell there, but between the divine power and daily life was a mass of complicated interferences, selfishness, self-interest, anger, hatred, disillusionments of all kinds, corruptions of conscience and of ethics. All of these things locked the individual away from the dweller in the innermost. It was necessary, therefore, that those who would approach this divine presence should be properly and duly prepared. And it was only in those moments of proper preparation that the fulfillment was made possible. So if the person asked for a divine favor and disliked his neighbor, he might not get it. If he wanted the strength to make a constructive decision, but lacked the morality in himself to make that decision, it might not be that he would have that support in those moments. He had to be worthy. The knight had to be worthy before the altar of his church. Everywhere, the approach to the divine must be based upon worthiness. And ways of achieving worldliness and worthiness are very interesting. All you have to do to be worldly is to drift along doing what you please. But if you wish to be worthy, then you must follow a very strict code of activity and conduct. Now, this code is not, however, a punishment. It is not an endless frustration of every natural human attitude and belief. It is not something that deprives us of the joys of life. The code, as it was known to the ancients, opened the gates of joy. The individual found that as he improved himself, his troubles slowly grew less. That as soon as he was able to overcome the selfishness in himself, he was then perhaps entitled to wealth or position. Whatever he did that was right in his home, in his business, in his world, made living easier. But it required decision. He had to decide whether he wished to destroy his own place in the plan, or by staying in that place, have a greater and more glorious fulfillment. So in the problem, we find in Eastern peoples also meditative disciplines, as we find in Zen, or as we find in the Sufis, or these different religious peoples. Always the highest achievement is the reward of being able to go into a mood or state of detachment from self-interest. As long as we think of ourselves first and cater to ourselves first, we will understand the meaning of the words, "and the first shall be last," because the basic principle is wrong. So as we go into the problem of vigil, we find, as Swami Vivekananda said on one occasion, that these disciplines are not things really that you settle down to for a few minutes a day. These disciplines become the natural life way. The individual is performing his meditation constantly. He is not thinking of meditation. He is doing all kinds of other preoccupied jobs and labors. He is in business, in home. Whatever he is doing, however, he lives in a continuous state of vigil because he is vigilant over himself. He is watchful to see that temptations are properly resisted and that in the presence of many opportunities to compromise principles, he remains true to the realities. Now, the reward of this is not simply that he has a little better time in his family, or is a better citizen, or a better parent, or a better child. The real reward is that he is gradually changing the polarity of his life, that he is gradually gaining the capacity to retire into the depths of the innermost in himself. In England and Germany during the 17th and early 18th centuries, there were a great many mystical movements, movements that were very largely devoted to a non-sectarian, non-theological experience of the presence of God. These mystical movements, such as the Pietists and the Quakers and others, Mennonites, these sects believed simply in living a vigil. They believed that every moment should be lived within a pattern of dedications, that the person who prays, prays most while he labors, and that the person who has no useful work has no religion, no matter what he may claim. Religion is service. It is the fulfillment of need. It is the taking care of the personal responsibilities. It is the individual defending his right to work, but not his work, not to his right to delay his labor. He is supposed to be constantly doing that which is next, proper, reasonable, and purposeful. Now, in this particular type of thinking, we know that the person trying to go more deeply into self finds one of the most common hindrances is lack of emotional control. He feels very good about loving his neighbor, until he meets his neighbor, and then he has difficulties. He is perfectly certain that he has a good job until someone talks him into dissatisfaction. He thinks he has a happy home until he discovers that his own willfulness is in danger of breaking it. All the way along, the individual's emotions taking over get him into difficulty. Now, it isn't emotion taking over that has done this, but it is emotion undisciplined, untrained, and unregenerate that has done the mischief. Emotions are something very beautiful, and the more beautifully they are appreciated and applied, the richer life becomes. But the emotion of affection can also be turned in ignorance into the emotion of hate. So the mystic seeking to refine and purify his own nature realized, as Böhme, the German mystic, realized, that all these destructive emotions disturb the relation of the individual to his own true self. Between the self as a divine being and the self as we find it in daily contact with people, the difference between these two is the difference between an internal eternal and an external temporal or temporal situation that do not reconcile. So actually, the problem of emotional control is best solved by quietude. It certainly isn't solved by watching television. It isn't served or sold or thought through rock music. It doesn't come to us as the result of the tremendous pressures of excitement, of competition, and of the constant determination to do what we want to do at all costs. But in this particular area, if we look around, we will see the tremendous penalty of lack of emotional control. If this control weakens too much, we have a psychotic condition. And excesses of emotion can lead to a hopeless mental sickness. No one really got terribly sick because they were kind, but they can get terribly sick if they are unkind. All around us in life are laws and rules. The American Indian believed this and was quite certain that these laws and rules were actually in the air around him all the time. All he had to do in order to achieve the peace of soul that he was seeking was to be quiet and let reality move in upon him. Let the sky speak to him. Let the earth be kind to him. Let all the creatures around share with him the energies and resources of life. And in vigil, there was this control of pressure. There was the individual sitting quietly, receptive to the divine will. Now, this is another point here, however, that is very important and is often comes up in connection with psychic experiences. Quietude is not negative. Quietude is not the individual opening the door to unknown visitors or the first burglar who wants to come in. Quietude is not negation. It is not a statement of helplessness. It is rather a statement of actual integration. Quietude cannot even be achieved by a person without discipline. If you don't think this is true, try it sometime. Try sitting down for 10 minutes without any conscious mental attitude, but living simply in the experience of peace. A very peaceful experience. Within 2 or 3 minutes, the mind will start to wander. We haven't any way of centering the mind subjectively, only objectively. So this thought of loving everyone may gradually lead into the realization that we are not very fond of several people. And as soon as this comes, the meditation is finished. It is no longer possible. The mind finds it almost impossible to prevent the intrusion of the objective. and the objectives are usually objections. It is very difficult for a person to be quiet except when he's asleep. If he becomes unconscious, he may still dream, but he doesn't remember it. But to be awake and quiet for any length of time can result in extreme nervousness, boredom, or an almost fantastic danger which seems to move in unless we once more make our connection with the external. The great Japanese psychologist, Morita, worked out a system for people who were naturally inclined to be neurotic. He pointed out that one of the first things the individual has to do is learn to live happily with himself. And nearly all people who are troubled are sorry for themselves, basically. They feel that they have been abused, they have been injured, they have been frustrated. So they keep on building this pattern until finally it comes into a dangerous antisocial attitude. Morita began, therefore, by taking a person who was neurotic or inclined to be and was bringing all kinds of dismal stories to the attention of his physician or practitioner. The first thing Morita made these people do was to go into a room without a book, without a word, without a friend, and simply be there by themselves with nothing to do whatever, not even a piece of string they could tie knots in, and stay that way until they finally had a talk with themselves. That was pretty rough. It sounds as though it'd be very, very easy. Many people say, if I could only be alone for a little while, I would be in heaven. But no one who is not self-disciplined can be alone and be happy. All this escape from confusion is due to a desperate effort to depart from the presence of self. Now, in self, I do not mean, as a psychologist would put it, merely a mental entity. I mean in self the deep, real, spiritual basis of our existence, the divine in us, the universal self that manifests through our personal self. The more universal we become, the more universal our divine self can manifest. But as long as we are locked in our attitudes, better attitudes simply cannot enter. The only time the individual with a bad adaptation to society can get along a little better is when a great disaster forces him to face himself for a short time. Then he forgets these little personal matters, but as soon as the danger passes, he drops back into himself again. In this case, into the self that is not real. So in Morita's therapy, vigil, called just simply plain getting to know yourself a little better, was the beginning of therapy. And the beginning of therapy in this case was to face self and live with it for 3 or 4 days and find what a monster it was. This little self, this mind self, this ego, with all its dependencies. And not far from Dr. Morita's establishment was a hospital built in Japan for the improvement of those with various degrees of actual mental ailments. This hospital was built by public funds and was located very beautifully in a very fine stretch of countryside. It was a very handsome institution to take care of the sick. The director of the institution decided that there was a form of therapy that hadn't been tried in his country, and that he would try it. He brought together a group of people, practically all of the inmates of this institution. Some hadn't spoken for years. Some cried all the time. Some hated each other. It was a group of sick people. So he took a beautiful piece of paper, or a large area of wall, or something of that nature, and he drew on it a pattern for the gardens of this institution. And he enlisted them all, assuming in his enlistment that they were all perfectly normal, that it was their opportunity and almost their responsibility to the emperor, most of all, that they do the gardening. They should design the garden. They should ask for the materials they needed. They should get together and discuss it. And when it was gradually developed, they should take care of it. And it was a problem and a job that would probably last a year or two. Before the end of the year, 60% of the inmates were dismissed as cured. Going out and doing it. Going out close to life with the natural sensitivity that these people have to beauty. Restored most of them, and in the remaining 40%, there was marked improvement. There was not a case in which there was not improvement. So this shows the importance not only of getting away from this isolation, which can be institutional, or it can simply be an individual isolation because of conduct and attitude, to get back into the beauty of life, to discover the wonders of life, and to realize that in gardening you are using the children of God, the flowers, to accomplish a work which was to stand for the presence of the divine. It was all very nice, and it worked, because every individual who is able to improve his relationship with himself is better off and will come nearer to what he may regard as happiness. How to do this, then, was to first of all begin to practice some type of vigil. And this can be, first of all, a simple vigilance, a comparative watchfulness over personal conduct. The individual can decide in his own mind, perhaps to keep a small diary of his own moods. He can also begin to think at the moment when he is irritated, whether the irritation is important enough to allow it to interfere with the presence of the divine within him. Can he hate people with sufficient value to himself if he realizes that as he hates people, he hates God? This is something that he has to think through. But it isn't so difficult at first. Children do very well with it. But the older people are afraid of the hole in the dark. They are afraid of all kinds of things that have become superficially associated with their lives. So it might be a good idea to follow the general thought of Vivekananda, and that is to consider your daily life as meditation, your daily life as your great religious dedication. Instead of thinking of religion being when you go to church, let's begin to think of religion, therefore, as when you go to work, when you go to the store, when you take the children to school. All of these things are just as religious as worship, because they are all done for the glory of the reality locked in life itself, a reality which can be released only by conscious dedication. So vigilance or carefulness becomes a basic vigil. It is something in which the person puts a guard upon himself and determines that he will accomplish that which is best for his own good. Now, these things may seem trite to a great many people, but over the years, you'd be surprised how many people have come to me with problems that they cannot forget the injustices they have suffered. They cannot forgive the relative who cheated them. They cannot forgive the businessman who shortchanged them. They cannot believe the woman who took away their husbands, or something of this nature. Everything is locked in pain. Then they get a medical diagnosis and are told they are really very sick, and this does the final work. Everything becomes hopeless. These people are a step from physical suicide, but they have already committed mental suicide by their attitude toward life. So for these people, there simply is no way out except by changing their own attitude. Now, it's very hard, maybe, to put a good attitude on top of a bad one and expect it to stick. It probably won't stick. But the vigil technique is different. Instead of building a good attitude on a bad one, vigil means simply to not have an attitude. Not allow positive or negative to take over. But that where previously there was a conflict, the answer is a condition of quietude. Quietude doesn't necessarily mean you've forgiven your enemy or that you have made a friend out of him. Quietude means that for the moment the whole situation is suspended. That there is no longer any emphasis. Nothing is feeding an attitude, especially a bad one. Without feeding attitudes, they starve to death just like any other part of life. And by not giving support or added emphasis to some ancient tragedy, you gradually get over it. Now, we all realize that in the memory processes, large and important incidents are remembered the longest. And people of older years who have forgotten the names of their own children still remember the unhappiness that happened to them when they were young. This type of memory is spotty, but the emphasis is upon critical situations in most cases. If the memory fails, of course, the individual forgets all his troubles. But the problem is how to keep the memory in good condition and still live with the problems and not let them take over. The one way that the ancients decided was that each person should finally come to realize that he was strangely an individual. He was a person, not a puppet that was having the strings pulled by something else. He was himself. Therefore, he was capable of building a life of his own. And the fact that thousands of people around him were living badly had no basic value for him. He had the right to do as he saw fit or believed. And if doing what he believed was not getting anywhere, then there was probably something wrong with his believing. So this has to be checked out. As long as we can believe that we can avenge ourselves, we will try. But when it gradually dawns upon us that what we call revenge is nothing but making ourselves sick, then it is not so hard to change. We always can remember that the person we dislike is not even aware that we are disliking them, or if they are aware, simply do not care. So the problem of getting ourselves out of the tangle is the thing that has to be considered. In Eastern nations, particularly, children are taught from very early life to have certain religious attitudes. They are taught that when trouble hits them or difficulties arise, be quiet. Be very quiet, but not negative. If the moment the individual is negative and allows all kinds of psychic phenomena to move in upon him, he may be in another difficulty. Because most psychic phenomena in some way is symbolical of self-interest. Something we want, something we do not want. It is self-pity, it is ambition, it is arrogance. It has nothing to do with the reality. Our dreams are highly psychotic. And very often our so-called waking dreams or mystical experiences are simply further evidence of our troubles, but not a solution to them. We are always looking for something to solve these problems. We are looking for a teacher who can take them all away from us. We are looking for a religion that will forgive them all. We are looking for a way of life in which we can make our mistakes without interfering with joy, peace, or happiness. This does not exist, and there can never be an achievement of it. The only way we can get over the pressures that make us unhappy is by reducing the pressure. In reducing the pressure, we have to find some way of getting over another tendency we have, and that is to defend the pressure in ourselves. When things get a little unhappy, what do? We turn on the TV, so we get ourselves off our minds. As soon as we turn it on, we get something else on our minds that's worse. But we feel very content about it, because for a couple of hours we did not remember that we disliked someone. This was relief, release. soon as we turned off the station, the problems came back. But these considered them to be interludes in which we could get our worries off of our minds. This is a complete fallacy, because these worries are not just simply clouds floating in the sky of our mind. These problems are simply the climate of the entire mental life, and we cannot escape it that way. Also, we also find all kinds of unimportant outlets which we seek to use to keep our minds off ourselves. Now, we can all have hobbies. Hobbies are wonderful things. They can do a great deal to help us. But the purpose of a hobby is not to make us forget our mistakes. The proper use of a hobby is to exercise the mind in a constructive or useful or pleasant way. But hobbies do not cure the basic ignorances from which we suffer. It's only after we get over the ignorance that we can really enjoy the hobby. Because enjoyment in its full sense, in all cases, depends upon the correction of internal attitudes. Now, there have been all kinds of systems set up. Some individuals try to find relief through religion. They join an organization, or as they used to do in the old days, they go through a riverside baptism, and they're saved. But the minister always tells those who know that he has to come back again next year and save the same person again. The salvation seldom lasts over a year. The individual, moved by common impulse, surrounded by friends who are pushing him forward, and part of a peer group that has been baptized, feels that he has achieved something, and it helps a little. He may drink a little less, he may be a little less annoying to other people. But in about a year, the old habits come back, and he has to start over again. Now, this is the way it is with most efforts to correct this type of condition. You cannot correct it from the outside. You cannot get anything into you through education or philosophy or ethics or anything that can definitely substitute for your own inner insight. After you get the insight, your philosophies become very valuable. After you know where you're going, the road map is important. But while you are still locked within the internal conflicts, no amount of external change can really correct the situation. You move out of a difficulty, but you take yourself with you, and the difficulty moves along. So we get this problem now of the quietude. Let's see how we're going to do this, or how it might be worked out in a pleasant way. Well, maybe the first thing to do is to simply sit down once a day and just relax. Just relax away from everything. Don't try to think of something nice. Don't try to think of something that isn't nice. Don't try to wiggle and twist and twitch until you get yourself all nervous again. Just sit down for a few moments and experience the peace and quietude of a universe that extends on and on through infinite durations, but is aware of the need of every living thing.